ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world right now is a disaster. It's easy to feel helpless. But there was a moment when millions of people around the world said enough. I'm Sisonkim Simong. Join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. How Australians joined others around the world to push back against racism and won.
Whites only teams, we thought that to the average Australian that would be despicable.
Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Two men are in a lab and they've been working hard to try and make antifreeze. They mix two chemicals together and expect to make a clear liquid. Instead, they end up with this black mess.
Kind of like licorice, I suppose.
It is not what they had in mind, and they have to start all over, but it's late, so they decide to go home and deal with the mess in the morning.
The next day, they come back to the lab, they try to clean up the lab, get rid of this thing that they'd made the day before, so they put it in the sink, and they can't for the life of them wash it down the sink.
They throw everything at this blob, and just, like, nothing dissolves it.
It was resistant to oils, to fuels, to solvents. It was elastic. It was chemically stable. And basically what they'd come up with was rubber, a synthetic form of rubber.
My name is Mark Fennell. And this synthetic rubber would go on to be used in cars, rockets and spaceships. And ultimately would be responsible for one of the deadliest space missions in history.
And as we go to air, NASA is about to hold a news conference on what is, tragically, America's worst disaster in space.
This is Mission Control, Houston, at 11:48 a.m. Central Standard Time. The search and rescue teams are delayed in getting into the area because of debris continuing to fall.
I would doubt very much that it would have been possible to get out with that kind of an explosion.
But, at the time, no one saw it coming. So, this is Fiona Pepper.
And I'm a science reporter with the science unit at Radio National.
Now, I get the impression that you've spent an enormous amount of the last couple of, months, I would say, thinking about rockets. Were you always into rockets or is this a relatively recent development?
No, this is very new. My space knowledge was non-existent 6 months ago, and probably for the last 8 months I have been deep in space shuttle disasters. So, yes, I've upped the ante in my space knowledge.
This is good. So you and I are coming from almost the exact opposite starting points here because I've always been obsessed with space. But the story that you're going to tell today is one that I had absolutely no concept of. So we're going to meet in the middle somewhere.
Great.
Okay, so to begin, you're going to take us back to 1926, quite literally 100 years ago, actually, and we're in Kansas City. Now, for people that, just to build an image in people's heads, like, what is Kansas City like a century ago?
So in 1926, Kansas City was essentially this major Midwestern rail ag and industrial hub. You know, it's a very prosperous time, late roaring 20s, and America is going through this major industrial expansion. There's not a lot of regulation. There's not a lot of oversight. So it's sort of a time ripe for experimentation and entrepreneurship. People are just trying stuff out.
Good time to be a crazy mad scientist, yes?
Yes.
Okay, so that leads us to two gentlemen, Nathan Manoukian and Joseph Patrick. Who are they? Well, let's start with Joseph Patrick.
We know a lot more about him than Nathan Manoukian, and he is interesting. He was a doctor. He worked in the US Army. He then segued to chemistry, and he clearly had more of an interest in chemistry than in medicine, and he liked to come up with things in his lab.
And there was one day where they came across something kind of by accident. Walk me through what happened this one day in the lab.
Okay, so in the 1920s, automobile ownership was expanding. Everyone wanted a car, and people needed antifreeze fluids. They were in demand. We wanted to come up with inexpensive antifreeze products. So that's what Nathan and Joseph were working away at in their lab, or at least attempting to. So apparently it's close to midnight. The pair have come back into their lab and they're inspecting this chemical compound that they'd been mucking around with earlier in that day. And so when they come into their lab, they expect to find a clear liquid. But instead what they find, it's this sort of a black strap of molasses, kind of like licorice, I suppose. And they're surprised by what they find. The next day they come back to the lab in the morning. They try to clean up the lab, get rid of this thing that they'd made the day before. So they put it in the sink and they can't for the life of them wash it down the sink. Doesn't matter what solvent they pour over this globulous thing that they'd made, it just wouldn't break down. So they just end up clogging up their sink in their lab.
In my mind, I have this image and it's basically that old B movie, The Blob. Am I close?
I think so. I mean, it stinks, it's hard, and they can't get rid of it. But, you know, rather than being like, oh, we just want to tidy up the lab and we just, oh, this is an inconvenience, they realize this thing that they've created is resistant to solvents. And that's really significant because most experimental byproducts dissolve or degrade, and this one doesn't.
Basically, what they had created by accident was a brand new kind of synthetic rubber. It takes them a couple of years to realise just how big a deal this was going to be, but by the late 1920s, they patent it and create a company, which they call Thiocol.
Which was combining the Greek words sulfur and glue.
Now, this is huge, right? Because before this moment, if you needed rubber, you basically needed latex trees. You needed to tap them. It was quite intense. It was quite an intensive process, wasn't it?
Yeah. So America relied basically solely on British-controlled Southeast Asian plantations. So coming up with a synthetic form of rubber was really significant, particularly when everyone wanted to own a car.
What is it that synthetic rubber can do that natural rubber can't? Because there's actually some quite big distinctions there, isn't there?
The main early use for this rubber that Thiocol came up with was for gaskets, for sealants, coatings and adhesives, that kind of thing. But basically, any application where solvent resistance and weather resistance was really important.
And it... One thing that's probably worth pointing out is compared to natural rubber, it kind of stank, didn't it?
Yes, it really stunk. Rotten eggs is the main description that I've come across.
That would be the sulfur, right?
Exactly. It stunk so much that locals complained about this horrible odour when it was being manufactured in Kansas City, which actually meant that they had to relocate to New Jersey to a kind of rubber industrial area where they could kind of stink the place out and no one cared. So, yeah, the smell was significant.
Okay, so you've got your stinky, weather-resistant, durable and affordable product that Americans can make without having to rely on the British. Fast forward to the 1940s and the synthetic rubber is no longer just being used for cars. They start to use it for rockets.
Yes. So it turns out that this synthetic rubber that they come up with, it was also useful as a sealant during the war because scientists discovered that it was also an excellent binder for solid rocket fuel. Solid rockets need almost like a glue to hold their fuel together without, you know, to stop it from cracking under pressure. And Thiocol knew how to make this. So by the late 1950s, Thiocol was considered a leader in solid rocket motors.
The years go by and the 1970s roll around and Thiocol's focus shifts slightly towards NASA.
The space shuttle program is kicking off. This is a massive national space program to be involved in. Thiocol won a contract with NASA to design and build the solid rocket boosters for the space shuttles for this program. Now, NASA had come up with this concept of a reusable spacecraft. This was the first ever reusable spacecraft. So this wasn't a one-off. They were going to be making space shuttles for decades. So to win this contract was a really big deal. And so it wasn't just building these solid rocket boosters. Because these solid rocket boosters were reusable, they would then restore them after they'd gone to space and back, prepare them and get them ready for another launch.
So what is it exactly that the company does for the space program here? What are they doing on the space shuttles?
Okay, so the space shuttle is made up of three major components, and there are three contractors who are employed to build these separate components. So first there's the orbiter, which people would be maybe familiar with. It's the winged spacecraft that kind of looks like a plane where the astronauts spend all of their time. Then there's the huge orange external tank, which holds the liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen to fuel the orbiter's main engines. And then thirdly, attached on either side were two massive solid rocket boosters. And these are the parts that Morton Thiokol was building in Utah. They were something like 15 stories high, and they were built in sections and then pulled by train from Utah to Cape Canaveral in Florida, where the space shuttles were being assembled. So they were massive. And the role of the solid rocket boosters, or the SRBs, was to provide the thrust needed to get this huge stack off the ground and into orbit. And then once that had happened, they got dropped into the ocean. They were collected, cleaned up, and then used again for the next launch.
Right, so Thiokol is busy building these solid rocket boosters for NASA. And once they're used, they are collected, cleaned off, and used for the next rocket launch. And Thiokol, they are churning out this work.
Because NASA had set out to make spaceflight super regular, like almost as normal as hopping on a domestic airline. And they were really frequent, but like nationally, NASA was having a bit of a PR problem because people were starting to lose interest. They'd set out to make spaceflight normal and they kind of succeeded. So by 1986, they had this PR problem where people were disengaged. TV networks weren't broadcasting launches, and so they had to come up with ways to re-engage the public. So they came up with this program called the Teacher in Space program.
The program was designed to inspire students and spark their curiosity in maths, science, and space exploration. The President Ronald Reagan announced it in 1984.
The program to someday carry citizen passengers into space. Until now, we hadn't decided who the first citizen passenger would be. But today I'm directing NASA to begin a search in all of our elementary and secondary schools and to choose as the first citizen passenger in the history of our space program, one of America's finest, a teacher.
And it worked. They got Americans on board. They got people around the world on board because the Teacher in Space program was essentially a talent quest to find the right teacher to send to space to teach a science class from space for, you know, the first time. And this woman by the name of Krista McAuliffe, she was selected and she was perfect. She was this charismatic, magnetic individual. So yeah, the tides sort of changed, I suppose. There was a lot of anticipation about this 1986 launch.
With a teacher chosen, NASA had reinvigorated the public's interest in space travel. Not just in America, by the way, around the world. 2 years go by and launch day finally arrives and you can cut the anticipation with a knife.
January 28th, 1986 in Cape Canaveral is a cold day, unusually cold day. So when all the, you know, NASA staff arrive at the Cape, the first thing they notice is ice. There is a lot of ice. The temperatures overnight had been below zero. There's big icicles hanging off the launch pad structure. And so for a lot of people, you know, it wasn't unusual for launches to be scrubbed. This particular mission was supposed to launch on January 23. There were a number of dates that had been missed in that week. So actually when staff arrived, they were like, nah, they're going to call this thing off.
But they didn't call it off.
NASA decided to go ahead. There was a huge crowd at Cape Canaveral looking up.
And it wasn't just locals watching on. Millions of people were tuning in to see the launch live on TV, including students in classrooms, to see a teacher, someone other than an astronaut, be sent into space. It was a huge day.
It was a big, big deal. Yeah.
Everything was going perfectly to plan, and the launch went off without a hitch.
There she goes, George.
There it goes.
That's brighter than usual.
Yeah, it is.
Everything was looking pretty normal until 73 seconds into that launch.
I don't remember it being that bright and that big. Look at that.
I don't either.
What was that part? Is that trouble or not?
When the space shuttle started to break apart and split into three sections.
NASA officials are still puzzled at what happened. Everything appeared to be going smoothly as the trouble-plagued shuttle finally beat the weather and took off into a clear blue Florida sky.
Now, for people on the ground who, you know, this was the first shuttle they'd ever witnessed launching, there was a lot of confusion. It was like, is it supposed to do that? We know that the solid rocket boosters come off, but it became quickly apparent that this wasn't right and this didn't look right.
We had good data on the solids and on the orbiter up until the time of the explosion, so everything is still very sketchy.
Anyone inside the shuttle could have survived the orange fireball and cascade of debris which showered the ocean for the next hour.
I would doubt very much, even if you had had an escape capsule on board or parachutes, that it would have been possible to get out with that kind of an explosion in any event.
And people in the flight control room obviously were aware that this had gone catastrophically wrong, and there were no survivors. There was no hope that the seven crew on board, including this incredible teacher, could have survived this space shuttle breaking up and then plunging into the Atlantic Ocean.
So you might recognise this story now, because yes, this is the Challenger space shuttle disaster. Seven astronauts died, and of course that teacher, Krista McAuliffe. It is hard to articulate the impact this had on everyone involved. It was a shock, it was a loss, but also for NASA, it's a massive dent in the public's confidence and the perception of the space program.
They'd had 24 successful launches until this point, so people had confidence that this was working and that this was, it was a day of celebration, and this launch was slightly different. You know, there were crew going up to do scientific work, but there was a teacher on board who was going to speak to you in your classroom, and it was profound sadness. And when you speak to people, although, you know, it's 40 years since the Challenger disaster, it's kind of a 9/11 moment where people can describe exactly where they were when they saw that footage or when they heard the news, when they were driving the car. And a lot of people thought they, you know, it was like a science fiction movie, or, you know, what they, when they turned on the TV and they saw images of this, of this space shuttle breaking apart, they didn't kind of know what they were looking at. It was otherworldly, I suppose. And, yeah, it wasn't just Americans. It was people all around the world.
Now, you're probably listening to this wondering, what on earth does this have to do with rubber? Well, initially when people started asking the question, what went wrong, a lot of the attention focused on the temperature, didn't it?
Mm, yeah, yeah. So people went, it must have been the ice from the night before. And, you know, that was a contributing factor.
But ice wasn't the whole story.
And it appeared that we had an early solid rocket booster separation.
A solid rocket booster separation. Yes, the connection is the rocket boosters that Thiokol worked on.
From looking at the launch footage, there was a thing called blow-by where a very hot gas had kind of escaped from one of the joints in the solid rocket boosters, and that had led to this catastrophic failure.
The joints were sealed together using something called an O-ring that was made from synthetic rubber.
So an O-ring is massive. I can't remember the exact dimensions, but, you know, you think of these 15-story high solid rocket boosters. They're broken up into seven segments, and at each joint there are O-rings inside of them. So they're like as thin as your little finger, but like meters in diameter, because they have to kind of fit this big rubber ring that fits around the edge of this solid rocket booster to seal that joint.
And the thing to remember here is that rubber, even synthetic rubber, it's bendy, it's elastic, it's reactive. But that is not the case
if it's cold?
That's what those engineers discovered.
Yes, so this is the important part. Before the launch, Morton Thiokol engineers raised a red flag. They were warning that those O-rings, made of rubber, they wouldn't work properly in the cold.
And there were a specific group of five engineers that were very, very concerned about this thing called blow-by. On January 27th, 1986, when they saw the forecast temperature for the following day, they freaked out. They freaked out that this launch was scheduled to happen. And basically they had had concerns for the last 5 years, and their specific job was working on these O-rings and on these joints on the solid rocket boosters. Like, this is what they did all day, every day. This was their job.
Now, remember, those solid rocket boosters were being reused, right? And time again, launched into the sky, dropped into the ocean, retrieved, cleaned up, used again. And these engineers had noticed something. They'd noticed that the O-rings, they weren't looking good.
They were seeing corrosion and erosion in the O-rings when they pulled these solid rocket boosters out of the sea. And these space shuttles are continuing to launch. And so they were losing sleep over this problem.
A full year before the Challenger disaster, they theorised the cold temperatures were actually exacerbating this problem. So when they see the forecast for the Challenger launch day, they call a meeting with management to warn them that if the launch goes ahead, it could be disastrous.
They go directly to their management at Morton Thiokol. Morton Thiokol management goes to NASA, to management in Florida, and they call this three-way teleconference, which is a big deal in the 1980s with, you know, the technology that we had access to then. It was also the first time in the history of spaceflight at NASA that a contractor had called a meeting to try and stop a launch. And basically there were five men who were at that teleconference trying to convince NASA management that it was not safe to launch.
One of those men was named Brian Russell, and this is what he told Fiona when she interviewed him.
My biggest regret in the whole episode was I just wish that when after our general manager said that we're go for launch, I wish I'd have said that there's a dissenting opinion here. I just so regret not having said that, which I don't know if it would have changed anything, but it would have caused other people to say, yeah, me too, and that we don't agree with what's happening here.
In some ways, this is a story that probably should be retitled, Someone Did See It Coming.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, they saw it coming.
What do you think this chapter of the history of synthetic rubber, what do you think it tells you about science and the progress of science?
You know, the discovery in the sink in the 1920s where they just couldn't wash this globular black stinky mess down the sink, it's significant in that fast forward to the late 1970s, that is contributing to fleeing these massive space shuttles into the sky. You know, it's not an unblemished legacy by any means, because, yeah, it was this time of experiment and invention, and that is essentially space flight. They talk about every space shuttle launch was a test flight. Something could have gone wrong. There were so many problems that engineers were grappling with. And just identify the one that's going to take you out. That's really something that stayed with me after doing all these interviews for this series.
And, of course, the way you can hear those interviews, you have actually put together this incredible five-part series on the Science Friction podcast about the Challenger legacy, of course, to mark the 40th anniversary. And those bits and pieces of interviews you heard before, they are just the tip of the iceberg, Fiona, that people can hear in that five-part series right now, can't they?
Yep. It's the Challenger legacy. I co-host the series with Dr. Carl, and this series comes out at an interesting time.
Fiona, this has been incredible. Thank you both for talking to me, but also for all those incredible interviews you've put together as well.
Thank you.
Fiona Pepper there, and she is the co-host of the Challenger legacy, which is in the Science Friction feed on ABC Listen or wherever you listen to your podcasts. This episode was produced by Zoe Ferguson and Rebecca Metcalf. No One Saw It Coming is made on Gadigal land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. I'm Mark Fennell. And if you have a story
We'd love to hear from you. All you need to do is email us, noonesawitcoming@abc.net.au, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.